buildings, precursor to the National Trust and English Heritage, which have done so much since then to care for Britain's rich architectural heritage. If you're energetic enough, you can walk from the Tower down to Broadway itself. They're both stops on the Cotswold Way, a 100-mile-long footpath that incorporates much of the area's best scenery. It's so lush and rustic in summertime that you could be forgiven for thinking that you'd gone to the Shire in Lord of the Rings and that hobbits might step out to greet you at any moment. The Cotswold Way, opened just since 2007, wanders from northeast to southwest, skirting the area's towns, keeping mainly to the high ground, and ending in the old spa town of Bath. As you can see, there's much variety to the English Midlands, from the grimy old industrial towns to the gentle Cotswold Vales. Continuously and densely settled for more than 2,000 years, it's a thoroughly domesticated landscape, but also one that's been well cared for and intelligently managed. To omit it from your travels would be, both literally and figuratively, to miss the heart of England.
Lecture 19, East Anglia.
East Anglia is the flattest part of Britain. It's hotter in summer and colder in winter than the rest of the country. Much of it is remote and rural, though in the Middle Ages, the city of Norwich was second only to London in size and importance. It comprises the counties of Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex, Cambridgeshire, and part of Lincolnshire. Large parts of it were once marshes and swamps, known collectively as the Fens. Several attempts to drain them and create farmland, beginning in the early 1600s, led to difficulties with the land sinking as it dried out. Not until the 19th century, when powerful steam engines were able to control water levels, could the area develop into some of the richest agricultural land in Britain. It's still a country of straight lines, long ditches, dikes, pumps, and windmills. There are just a few patches of the old fenland left. One is Wicken Fen Nature Reserve, between Cambridge and Ely. A range of traditional plants and sedges makes this an area of exceptional ecological interest. A labyrinth of footpaths weaves through the area, often on boardwalks to prevent you from getting soaked. Herds of Highland cattle and horses graze the land. Tall hides make it a favoured place for ornithologists. This is the area where, as an undergraduate, Charles Darwin came to gather beetles, one of his earliest biological enthusiasms. In the 1920s and 30s, Arthur Tansley and Harry Godwin, pioneering ecologists from Cambridge, worked here. Tansley developed the concept of the ecosystem, which has become central to our understanding of the environment. He recognised that there was a constant exchange taking place between plants, animals, insects, birds, sun, soil and water, the living and the non-living in any given area, and that the whole should be understood as a system. Just a few miles from Wicken Fen, it's possible to visit the Streatham Old Engine, one of the steam-powered beam engines, still fired up occasionally, that made fen drainage really effective. And nearby, there's a pumping station that's been converted into the Prickwillow Museum, which tells the story of fen management in the region. Another of the great fen areas is the Norfolk Broads, much further east. This is an area where, over the centuries, peat was gathered for fuel. Peat is a kind of precursor to coal, not so dense, of poorer quality, and smoky to burn. As it was removed, the area gradually flooded and became a maze of rivers, ditches, and dikes. It's become a boater's and fisherman's destination, and is also an area of great natural diversity. The first vivid personality known to us from East Anglian history is Queen Boudica, or Boadicea. leader of an anti-Roman rebellion in AD 60. Her husband was king of the Iceni, with territory in present-day Norfolk. After being flogged and witnessing the rape of her two daughters, Boudica fought back. She captured the towns of Colchester and London, killing everyone she captured, but then suffered an annihilating defeat once the Romans had regrouped. Tacitus tells us that, before the battle, she explained herself like this. "It is not as a woman descended from noble ancestry, but as one of the people that I am avenging lost freedom, my scourged body, the outraged chastity of my daughters. This is a woman's resolve. As for men, they may live and be slaves." We don't know exactly where the battle was fought, but we do know that Boudica enjoyed a great surge of popularity in the reign of Queen Victoria. Both queens' names signify military triumph. A fine statue of Boudica stands on a plinth at the end of Westminster Bridge, right under Big Ben. It was made by Thomas Thornycroft in the 1860s and has been there since 1902. In the 1980s, political cartoonists sometimes compared Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher to her. Another East Anglian rebel against foreign invaders was Hereward the Wake, who opposed the Normans in the 1060s and early 1070s. His base was the town of Ely, now surrounded by dry land, but then known as the Isle of Ely. When a Norman army advanced against Hereward across a wooden causeway, the weight of the men and their armour was so great that they sank into the marshes. The Normans, undeterred, bribed local monks to show them a safe approach and were finally able to take the town. Hereward disappears from history after that, either pardoned, exiled, or killed, depending on which source you read. He too enjoyed a great Victorian revival, and is the central figure in a novel by Charles Kingsley. Like Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, Kingsley's novel uses the idea that the free, happy, and independent people of Anglo-Saxon England were burdened under a tyrannical Norman yoke, and that resistance in the name of freedom was justified. Ely is home to a beautiful medieval cathedral. Its most distinctive feature is the octagonal lantern over the Great Crossing. There used to be a tower, but it crashed down into the body of the church one day in February 1322. The lantern was built in its place, lighter in weight and admitting daylight, so that this central part of the cathedral is superbly beautiful, above all on sunny days. At the Reformation, many of the statues integral to the structure were smashed as part of the Protestant reaction against worshipping graven images. Most of the windows were broken too, but the cathedral itself survived. A huge makeover in the Victorian era installed the lovely stained glass that you can see there today, and a brightly decorated ceiling. Because the cathedral is built on the only high ground in the entire area, it's visible from 20 or 30 miles away on clear days, dominating the neighbourhood and extremely picturesque. Ely, like most of East Anglia, was fervently puritanical in the era of the Reformation. Two men were burned at the stake on the green in front of the cathedral in 1555, in the reign of Catholic Queen Mary, because they denied that bread and wine were turned into the body and blood of Christ by transubstantiation. In the 1630s and 40s, Oliver Cromwell lived there in a black and white timbered home that's now a museum of his life and work. Another East Anglian site marked by religious conflict is Walsingham in Norfolk. There, in the Middle Ages, stood the house in which the angel Gabriel told the Blessed Virgin Mary that she would become the mother of the promised Messiah. You may wonder why the house was in England and how it got there. Well, in 1061, a noble widow named Richeldis had a vision. In it, she was carried by the Virgin Mary to see the original house in Nazareth and was encouraged to take its measurements so that she could make a copy in England. Richeldis then asked some local carpenters to build the replica, but they were mysteriously unable to get the job done. Contractors must have been just the same then as they are now. After a night of prayer, however, Richeldis discovered at daybreak that the house had miraculously materialized on her land. It became a shrine, and then a great Augustinian priory was built around it. The presence of a vial of the Virgin's milk made the place even more attractive to pilgrims, royalty included, who flocked there for the next five centuries. The Walsingham Shrine was second only to Canterbury as England's leading pilgrimage site. Henry VIII visited as a young man, but put a stop to the whole business in 1538 at the dissolution of the monasteries. As with so many other abbeys and priories around Britain, the land was given to a courtier who built a secular house amid the ruins of the old medieval buildings. Jump forward now to 1829, when the last legal restrictions against Britain's remaining Roman Catholics were lifted, and they began to reclaim a presence on the national landscape. In 1897, Pope Leo XIII revived the pilgrimage. Since the original site had been destroyed, Catholic pilgrims were now directed to the Slipper Chapel in the adjacent village of Houghton St. Giles. This building had been the last way station on the pilgrim route, had fallen into disuse, and the building had become an animal barn. Bought and restored by a well-to-do convert to Catholicism, it now became the principal focus of the Catholic pilgrimage. From it, pilgrims would remove their shoes and walk the last mile into the village of Walsingham itself. The story takes another turn in 1921, when the local Church of England vicar, Alfred Hope Patton, created an Anglican shrine in Walsingham at the local parish church of St. Mary. The Church of England has never quite been able to make up its mind whether or not it's really a Protestant church or still part of the Catholic communion. High Anglicans, like Father Patton, are emphatic that they are still linked in some way to Catholicism, and they favour a more sacramental approach to worship, including confession and the cult of the saints. Once Anglican processions began to compete with Catholic processions at Walsingham, radical Protestant Anglicans would sometimes show up as critics. On the other hand, the coexistence of two shrines in the area has encouraged ecumenical or inter-church cooperation, especially in more recent decades. In 1948, a group of English Catholic World War II veterans, who were now college students, carried a wooden cross from London to Walsingham over the course of 7 days, timing their arrival to Good Friday, which commemorates the crucifixion. This event, known as Student Cross, caught on, and is now undertaken from many different starting points around Britain. Since 1972, it too has been explicitly ecumenical. Britain's a far less actively religious country than the United States, but a visit to Walsingham, especially if it comes around Easter or around the September Feast of the Virgin Mary, shows that at least among a minority, a fervently active Christianity is still alive and well. The Anglican shrine, which also contains a replica of the Virgin's house, is the dominant presence, with gardens, a church, beautiful glass, candles, statues of saints, and a pilgrim's centre. The little town is dotted with shops where you can buy statues of the saints or icons, with everything set among picturesque old houses. There's also a newly built Catholic church on the market square. And a mile down the road at Houghton, the Slipper Chapel has a retreat centre of its own for Catholics. Like most other parts of Britain, Norfolk is dotted with old castles and stately homes. Best of the castles, I think, is Castle Rising near King's Lynn. Built in the mid-1100s, it's a gaunt Norman tower, as matter-of-fact as the Great Keep at Dover. It became politically important in the 1320s and 30s. Roger Mortimer, one of the mighty Marcher lords who rebelled against King Edward II, took the king's wife, Queen Isabella, as his mistress. Her nickname, incidentally, was the She-Wolf of France. Edward died or disappeared in mysterious circumstances. The two of them were widely believed to have murdered him. They effectively ruled England after that as regents, until the young king, Edward III, rebelled against them, killed Mortimer, and had his mother imprisoned. Castle Rising was the place he chose, and she spent most of the rest of her life there, from 1330 until her death 28 years later. Three of the most interesting country houses, all from later eras, are Houghton, Holcombe, and Blickling. Blickling was the home of Mary Boleyn, who became Henry VIII's mistress. And it was the birthplace of Anne Boleyn, her sister, who became Henry VIII's second wife. The house now at Blickling was built in the early 1600s on the site of the older one. It's a marvellous Jacobean structure, bursting with self-confidence and with dazzling formal gardens dating from the 1840s. It sometimes appears on most haunted house in Britain lists because Anne Boleyn appears headless each year on the anniversary of her execution. The interior is sumptuously rich. In the extensive grounds, a stiff walk from the house itself stands a pyramid built by Joseph Bonamy in 1793 for the second Earl of Buckinghamshire as a family mausoleum. Houghton Hall, built in the 1720s and 30s, was the home of Robert Walpole, the man usually regarded as Britain's first Prime Minister. Walpole was just 12 years old during the Glorious Revolution of 1688 and grew up hearing tales of the Civil War, Regicide, Protectorate and Restoration that had taken place in the decades just before his birth. No wonder he became a specialist in cultivating political stability. A fine speaker, shrewd manipulator of men and builder of political alliances, he dominated British political life from the late 1710s almost until his death in 1745. He also enriched himself on the grand scale, as a glance at Houghton can confirm. Holcombe Hall, from the same era, owes a debt to the Palladian revival style that I mentioned in my lecture on Enlightenment Britain. William Kent worked on it, just as he did on Chiswick House. The most interesting occupant of Holcombe was Thomas Coke, who's a famous figure in the history of British agriculture. Immensely wealthy and influential, he held annual farming fairs, or shearings, at the estate in the late 1700s and early 1800s, studied selective animal and plant breeding, corresponded with agricultural scientists, and showed that careful record keeping and systematic crop rotation could increase yields, improve crops, and generate a larger income. That was significant as a foundation for the Industrial Revolution. One of the things that industrialism presupposed, after all, was an available food supply for the growing number of factory and mine workers. Thomas Coke was one of the people who showed that agriculture could become far more productive and efficient by abandoning traditional methods and applying the insights of science and systematic study. Fittingly, one of the stone memorials at Holcombe, the Leicester Monument, is topped not by a military hero, but by a sheaf of wheat. Around its base, a statue is not of lions or soldiers, but of farm animals and equipment, a sheep, an ox, a seed drill, and a plough. I think it's a marvellous parody of Nelson's Column, but emphasising peaceful rather than warlike pursuits. Norwich itself, the county town of Norfolk, is full of medieval remains. It has a series of beautiful old medieval lanes, cobbled and wandering across the quiet area near the river. They're cleaner than they must have been 500 years ago, but otherwise not much changed. Norwich Castle, standing on the highest land in the city, is a Norman keep, but a much larger block than those at Castle Rising or Dover. The cathedral was built using stone imported from Normandy. It's one of the most complete and impressive Romanesque buildings in England. In fact, it rivals Durham, equally impressive inside and out, and sitting in a calm and opulent close of old Georgian buildings. Norwich officials had the very sensible idea of identifying and promoting all the town's best heritage sites as a package, and they're now known as the Norwich 12. Get a map of them when you arrive in the city and tour all of them. Easy enough, even on foot. One of them is the Catholic cathedral, built at the end of the 19th century, but according to neo-Gothic principles, and appearing, to unwary viewers, as almost the contemporary of the Anglican cathedral, rather than 800 years newer. I also like the fine old textile mill beside the river, and Norwich's City Hall from 1938, whose bronze doors are decorated with low-relief illustrations of men and women at work, and one illustration of the Anglo-Saxons who helped shape the city's history. People honoured in Norwich include Admiral Nelson, who was born and raised in Burnham Thorpe, Norfolk, nearby, and Edith Cavell, a heroic figure in the history of nursing. She was born in 1865 in Swardston, Norfolk, daughter of the local vicar, and became first a governess and then a nurse before emigrating to Belgium. During World War I, she cared for wounded soldiers from both sides while helping British soldiers to escape across enemy lines. For this activity, she was arrested, tried, and shot by a German firing squad. She became a martyr in British eyes and is recognised as a saint by the Church of England. Just outside the arched entrance to Norwich Cathedral stands a monument to Edith Cavell, showing a grateful soldier reaching up to give her a laurel wreath. It's almost inevitable that the restaurant across the road should be called the Edith Cavell. I haven't said much in this series about British music, though the nation has a rich musical heritage. East Anglia has inspired some of the best. For example, Ralph Vaughan Williams was one of several British composers to travel the countryside collecting folk songs that had never been written down and that were in danger of being lost. In the Norfolk port of King's Lynn, about 1905, he collected the songs that he incorporated into the first and second Norfolk Rhapsodies, symphonic pieces that have become much-loved parts of the English orchestral repertoire. Vaughan Williams and his friend Cecil Sharp thought English music had become too deferential to the great German tradition, stretching from Bach to Beethoven to Brahms, and that this was a way of setting it back on native ground. East Anglia's most famous musician is the 20th century composer Benjamin Britten. He was born in a big house in the east coast port of Lowestoft. His father, a dentist, was indifferent to music, but his mother was head of the local amateur music society and was delighted to find her son enthusiastic and talented. As a 9-year-old, at a concert in Norwich, he first heard a modern orchestral work, Frank Bridges' The Sea. He was astonished by it and arranged as a teenager to take composition lessons from Bridge. Britten's 1945 opera, Peter Grimes, is the story of a Suffolk fisherman based on a poem by George Crabbe. Crabbe himself came from Aldborough, a Suffolk fishing port that's now become a popular seaside resort town. His poem tells the tale of a cruel fishing boat captain whose apprentices have repeatedly died under mysterious circumstances. Has he murdered them, or have they died by misadventure? In any event, their ghosts haunt him and finally drive him to madness. Britten's version of the story in the opera creates more ambiguity. Is Grimes a villain, or is he a great man, misunderstood by the small-minded people around him? Britten was homosexual, living for most of his life with the tenor Peter Pears, who sang the premieres of many Britten works. Peter Grimes has sometimes been understood as an allegory about social intolerance toward homosexuals. Achieving rapid success as a composer, Britten moved to Aldborough itself, to a place known as the Red House, which is now a museum. He founded the Aldborough Festival in 1948. It was a success from the start and has continued up to the present, becoming an important event in Britten's musical calendar. As it became more popular, it needed larger premises. It moved from Aldborough to the Old Maltings at Snape, 3 or 4 miles upriver. Malting processes barley for beer brewing. The Victorian Maltings factory had recently gone out of business. It was now converted into a concert venue and was opened by the Queen in 1967 and has been the site of the festival each June ever since. Snape is also by now an artist's colony and crafts centre with garden shops and restaurants, bustling every weekend and surrounded by beautiful fenland. On the beach at Aldborough is a statue in tribute to Britain. It is the Scallop by Suffolk artist Maggie Hambling, a great broken shell about 15 feet high, made of stainless steel and incorporating a line from Peter Grimes. I hear those voices that will not be drowned. When I was there, some of the visitors clearly knew exactly what it was and why it was there. Others looked perplexed and were happy to let their children scramble over it. At Aldborough, you're a short drive from Sutton Hoo, an Anglo-Saxon ship burial site, which I discussed in my lecture on Anglo-Saxon England. You're also close to the homes of the 18th century painters Gainsborough and Constable, which I'll describe in my lecture on British artists. A few miles north, you'll come to Dunwich Heath, a coastal moorland that's part of the region's area of outstanding natural beauty. The vegetation, unremarkable in winter, turns to brilliant pinks, yellows and purples every summer when the gorse and heather are in bloom. It's been preserved against building by the Neptune Coastline Campaign, a scheme to keep as much as possible of Britain's coastline free from commercialisation. It's now a magnet for birdwatchers because several unusual species gather there, including avocets and bitterns. A breeding pair of stone curlews, very rare in Britain, with long yellow legs and big nocturnal eyes, fledged a chick there in 2017. The Royal Society for the Protection of Birds has a centre in the nearby village of Minsmere. Slightly inland stands Framlingham, an old market town and the ancestral home of the Howard family, Dukes of Norfolk, who had a gift for getting on the wrong side of the Tudor monarchs. One of them, Thomas, the second Duke, fought on the wrong side at the Battle of Bosworth Field and ended up in the Tower of London, with Framlingham Castle confiscated and given to a Tudor loyalist. He finally got it back, but his son, Thomas Howard, third Duke of Norfolk, refused to go along with the Reformation, staying loyal to the Catholic faith. He was sentenced to death, but had a miraculous reprieve when Henry VIII died the day before he was scheduled to be beheaded. His sentence was commuted by Edward VI, but he was kept in jail. He experienced a brief euphoric moment of success in 1553 when Mary Tudor rallied her forces at Framlingham, marched on London, overthrew Lady Jane Grey, and became queen, with the promise of restoring the Catholic faith. Not 20 years later, however, his grandson, the fourth Duke, also named Thomas Howard, was sentenced to death by Queen Elizabeth I for treason. This time the sentence was carried out, and the castle was forfeit once and for all. Framlingham Castle is still very much worth a visit because of its great setting on top of the area's only hill, because of its historical associations, and because in the 18th century a red brick poorhouse was built inside the curtain wall. It must have looked incongruous in its early days, but the passage of time and the gentle weathering of all the stonework have given it by now an aura of dignified antiquity. The county of Suffolk prospered in the late Middle Ages as a centre of the wool trade. Its merchants devoted much of their surplus wealth to immense churches which still stand as monuments to their success. In the village of Lavenham, for example, the Church of St. Peter and St. Paul, on a gentle rise, dominates the entire landscape. It rivals in size and splendour some of England's smaller cathedrals. Built mostly in the late 1400s and early 1500s in perpendicular Gothic style, just before the Reformation, it has elaborately carved stonework and a soaring, decorated flint tower, higher than that of any other village church in the country. Everything about it declares its confidence and grandeur. The village of Lavenham itself is full of ancient houses, being one of the best-preserved medieval settlements in England. The old Guildhall of Corpus Christi is the most striking building. Built in the same era as the church and finished in 1529, it was the meeting place of the wool merchants and starting point of processions to the church on religious feast days. As the biggest and most central building in town, it became a community centre too. By 1600, changes in the textile business had thrown Lavenham on hard times, which is partly why so many of the medieval buildings remain. The owners couldn't afford to update their houses. The Guildhall became the community's workhouse and bridewell, or jail. When I visited, a curator with a gift for storytelling told me about an 8-year-old orphan girl who was imprisoned there in the 1770s for running away from the neighbouring town's workhouse. When she did it 3 more times, she was sentenced to transportation to Britain's harsh prison colony in Australia, then in its very earliest days. East Anglia is a pleasure to visit, as much the places you haven't heard of as those you have. Gentle, rustic, often remote, strikingly flat in most parts. It's within easy reach of London by car for a day's visit, but repays a longer stay if you can manage it.
Lecture 20, England's West Country.
When people talk about Britain's West Country, they're typically referring to the counties of Cornwall, Devon, Somerset, Dorset, Gloucestershire and Wiltshire. This is the area of Britain most associated with King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. According to legend, Arthur was taken to the Isle of Avalon as his life neared its end. There, in a deep sleep, he awaits the moment when England will call on him again to come to its rescue. The obvious question, where is Avalon? One candidate is Glastonbury, where a solitary hill, Glastonbury Tor, rises out of the Somerset Levels. For centuries, the levels were swampland, which would indeed have made the hill an island. Did any important people go to Glastonbury before Arthur? According to Arthurian lore, one was Joseph of Arimathea. He had witnessed the crucifixion of Jesus, captured some of his blood in a cup, the Holy Grail, then brought it by boat to Glastonbury. Stepping ashore, he stuck his staff into the firm ground, where it miraculously turned into a tree, the Glastonbury thorn, of a kind found nowhere else. Its sacredness was confirmed when it flowered twice each year, once at Easter and once at Christmas. According to another legend, Jesus himself came to Glastonbury. That's what William Blake was getting at in his poem of 1804, Jerusalem. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills? He posed these questions as a way of lamenting that Britain, once divinely blessed, had now become a land of dark satanic mills, the new industrial factories. Whatever the rights and wrongs of these legends, Glastonbury is a good place to visit. At first glance, it's similar to many of the small market towns of southwest England, such as nearby Wells and Shepton Mallet. At second glance, however, you begin to notice guitar-strumming hippies on public benches, astrological bookstores, aromatherapy spas, and all the paraphernalia of a New Age centre. You soon learn that in recent years, it's also been the site of a massive annual music festival, usually on the last weekend in June, which attracted upwards of 150,000 people. Glastonbury Abbey was once second only to Westminster Abbey in wealth. It suffered a catastrophic fire in 1184, after which the monks decided to emphasise their Arthurian connection as a way of building a lucrative pilgrimage. They alleged that they discovered the remains of Arthur and Guinevere nearby, reinterring them at the abbey in regal splendour. Sure enough, the pilgrimage thrived, until Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries in the 1530s. Now the abbey is a roofless ruin. Also ruined and roofless is St Michael's Tower on the top of Glastonbury Tor. This symmetrical hill, standing alone on the otherwise flat plain, looks almost as though it might have been built by human labour, but in fact, it's natural. A wooden church on the summit was destroyed by earthquake in 1275. In the 1300s, a stone church replaced it, of which St. Michael's Tower is the only remnant. It must have been tough work dragging the stones to the summit for its construction. It's hard enough walking up unencumbered, but you should do the climb if you possibly can. I did it recently on a warm, still day. Wonderful views in every direction made it more than worth the effort. People of all kinds and all ages, including a man in a meditative trance, shared the summit. Another magnet for visitors to Somerset is the Cheddar Gorge, where the ground makes an abrupt transition from fertile lowland to the stony Mendip Hills. Craggy rock spires rise up at the sides of a narrow zigzag valley, giving travellers briefly the impression that they've moved from England to Switzerland. Rock climbers love the area, which is full of challenging routes. Tours of the area's limestone caves reveal elaborate formations of stalagmites and stalactites. In one of the caves in 1903 was discovered the almost complete skeleton of a man about 10,000 years old. The cave also disclosed evidence of cannibalism. Paul, could you tell us something about the distinctive foods and drinks of the area?
I'll certainly be glad to give it a try, Patrick. Let's start with cheddar. Everyone has heard of cheddar cheese. This is its point of origin. And it was in the labyrinth of damp and temperate caves that the original cheesemakers aged their distinctive product. Cheddar remains today Britain's most popular cheese. Somerset is also a cider-making county. Apple trees grown from seeds rather than by grafting usually produce inedible fruit, but they're serviceable as the starting point for this potent alcoholic drink. At its worst, in a concoction called scrumpy, the consumer can actually feel his vital organs being transformed for the worse, though local people claim to love it. Milder versions like blackthorn cider are carbonated, sweeter, and more palatable.
Moving south from Somerset into Dorset, you'll encounter a succession of sleepy, rustic villages. One of them, Tolpuddle, comes as a surprise because it's sacred ground for Britain's trade unionist, whom you might otherwise associate with the industrial towns. In 1833, a group of six simple farm labourers facing severe wage reductions joined together in a friendly society, an early form of trade union. Since 1824, such organisations had been legal, but the British government was jittery about working class radicals. The farm labourers made the mistake of swearing a secret oath to be loyal to one another. In doing so, they violated a law of 1797, passed when fears of the French Revolution had been at their height, and when the Royal Navy had just suffered a mutiny. All six were convicted and sentenced to penal transportation to Australia, Britain's prison colony. Trade unionists, but also decent people throughout the kingdom, who knew that the Tolpuddle men were being scapegoated, petitioned the government for their pardon, described them as martyrs, and held great protest marches. I'm happy to say that they succeeded. The men were pardoned, and all but one returned to Britain, though several later tried their luck in another colony, Canada. Little Tolpuddle, in the valley of the River Piddle, suddenly took on a burden of symbolic significance. On the centenary of the men's trial, in 1934, the Trades Union Congress built a terrace of six workers' houses there, each named after one of the labourers. The central space of the terrace is a museum, retelling the story in highly partisan rhetoric, and adding a summary history of British trade unionism since then. In front of the building now stands a statue of a stone bench with six places, one of which is occupied by a farm labourer in obvious distress. Every July, the Trades Union Congress holds a local festival and march to commemorate the story. Another place where the Tolpuddle martyrs are remembered is at the waterfront in Plymouth in Devonshire, 100 miles to the south and west. A wall plaque shows the place where the returning men, pardoned, came ashore in 1838 to a hero's welcome. Right next to it are the famous Mayflower Steps. According to tradition, this is where the passengers of the Mayflower left English ground for the last time as they set out in 1620 on their voyage to New England. In 1934, a modest portico with Doric columns was built there, along with twin flagpoles from which fly the Union Jack and the Stars and Stripes. It's a good place to meditate on the long history of Anglo-American friendship, which has probably done more good for the world than any other bilateral relationship. Plymouth is a dramatic town with a colourful history. Built on a steeply sloping limestone site with old fortress walls, its high point is an open common or park called Plymouth Hoe. In 1588, when the Spanish Armada was sailing up the English Channel, lookouts spied the enemy fleet in the distance and rushed to tell Sir Francis Drake. He was playing bowls on Plymouth Hoe with his fellow privateers and a group of Royal Navy captains. Coolly, Drake told the messengers, "There is time enough to play the game out first and thrash the Spaniards afterwards." So it proved. Drake and the others sallied out from Plymouth when the tide had turned and attacked the Spanish ships repeatedly in a running battle up the English Channel. They prevented the Armada from picking up infantrymen in the Netherlands, as planned, by sending burning fireships into their midst, forced them out into the North Sea, and left them prey to storms and rocks as they rounded the northern tip of Scotland on their long journey home. Excellent seamanship and long-distance cannons played a role in this achievement, but Britain also credited divine intervention in the form of a providential Protestant wind which had blown to favour their tactics. This was the moment when Britain began its long rise to world naval supremacy, a position it held until World War II. When you look at the Great Armada Memorial on Plymouth Hoe and the fine statue of Francis Drake, you'll doubt that they date back to the late 1500s. Sure enough, they're Victorian. The Armada Memorial was set up in 1888 to celebrate the 300th anniversary of the battle. The granite monument carries a statue of Britannia, the female personification of Britain. It also features cannons, cannonballs, and the biblical inscription, "He blew with his winds, and they were scattered." Drake himself came from the nearby Devonshire town of Tavistock, where you can visit his home, Buckland Abbey. When he bought it in the early 1580s, local people born earlier in the century could remember Buckland's former role as a Cistercian monastery. To buy it and live in it was, in other words, a defiant assertion of Protestantism, consonant with Drake's entire career. The house, now owned by the National Trust, contains a display about Drake's daring round-the-world voyage in the Golden Hind in 1577-80, a privateering voyage so lucrative that it prompted Queen Elizabeth I to knight him and enabled Drake to buy Buckland Abbey. The house also contains a replica of Drake's drum, which he had with him on his round-the-world voyage, and again on his last voyage to Panama in 1596. According to legend, the drum will begin to play whenever Britain is in danger. Various people claim to have heard it at moments of great peril. Henry Newbolt, a patriotic poet of the British Empire, wrote Drake's Drum in 1897. It includes these lines, delivered by Drake as he lies dying in the Caribbean.
"Take my drum to England, hang it by the shore, strike it when your powder's running low. If the dons sight Devon, I'll quit the port of heaven and drum them up the channel as we drummed them long ago."
As with the King Arthur legend, it's the promise of a great warrior to rescue Britain in its hour of need, along with the implication that he never really died. West from Buckland Abbey, in the county of Cornwall, lies the exposed high country of Bodmin Moor. It's the wildest area in Cornwall, dotted with exposed stone crags, one of which, Brown Willie, is the county's high point at nearly 1,400 feet. Bodmin Moor is an area of outstanding natural beauty and home to several rare bird species. Archaeologists have also discovered evidence of Neolithic farming and hunting communities and numerous stone circles that were probably religious in origin. Much more recently, the beast of Bodmin Moor was a mythical panther or panther-like cat that supposedly stalked the area, preying on local farmers' sheep and cattle. A matter-of-fact government investigation denied its existence in a report of 1995, but sightings persist. At the edge of the moor stands Jamaica Inn, named for the local Trelawney family, two of whose members were royal governors of Jamaica. This is smugglers' country. The whole of Cornwall was famous in the 18th and early 19th centuries as a smuggler's paradise. High import duties on luxury goods, such as rum, brandy and silk, created an incentive to evade the tax. Cornwall had a long coast, few revenue agents, and plenty of seafarers eager to participate. As Adam Smith wrote, making the argument for free trade, a smuggler is a person who would have been in every respect an excellent citizen had not the laws of his country made that a crime which nature never meant to be so. Jamaica Inn, built in 1750, was an exchange point where smuggled goods were brought from the coast and sold to buyers who carried them off to other parts of the kingdom. On a more sinister note, Cornwall was also wreckers' country. Wreckers lured ships onto the rocks that line the shore by deliberately misleading their captains with signal lights. Salvage law permitted them to profit from whatever they could drag from the wrecked ships. For many people, Cornwall's somewhat notorious history is best known from the works of the novelist Daphne du Maurier. Although a native of London, du Maurier spent much of her life in Cornwall. One day, in 1930, while riding around Bodmin Moor with a friend, she got lost in the fog. Stumbling upon Jamaica Inn, they sheltered there until the weather improved. A local clergyman passed the time by telling them Cornish legends. The event inspired her to write Jamaica Inn, which became a bestseller and was then made into a movie by Alfred Hitchcock. It's the story of Mary, an orphan, who goes to live with her aunt at the inn, only to discover that her uncle, the landlord, Jos Merlin, is head of a smugglers and wreckers ring. Here's how she describes him.
The best things left to him were his teeth, which were all good still and very white, giving him the lean and hungry appearance of a wolf. And though there should be a world of difference between the smile of a man and the bared fangs of a wolf, with Jos Merlin, they were one and the same.
In addition to Jamaica Inn, du Maurier wrote numerous moody, atmospheric tales with supernatural overtones, including two other works that inspired Hitchcock films, Rebecca and The Birds. But her output also includes some excellent non-fiction books about England's West Country, among them Vanishing Cornwall and Enchanted Cornwall. To read them is to sink into the area's distinctive mood. Jamaica Inn, still a hotel where you can stay, now houses a little shrine to du Maurier, including her writing desk and a smugglers and wreckers museum. South of Jamaica Inn, you'll find the little town of St. Austell, and nearby, a great ecological experiment called the Eden Project. At first glance, you could think you'd come to a space-age Mars colony because of the vast domed structures set in a crater. It's actually an experimental garden with two major biomes under the domes, one recreating the conditions of a tropical rainforest, the other a drier Mediterranean environment. The crater was made not by asteroids, but by humans digging for China clay over the course of nearly two centuries. When the clay pit was worked out, it was taken over by Tim Smith, a one-of-a-kind entrepreneur and ecological activist. Smith started life as an archaeologist, but then switched into the record business, at which he made enough money to begin two environmental projects. One was to revive the Lost Gardens of Heligan, an achievement I'll describe in my lecture on British gardens. The other was the Eden Project, which is meant to provoke constructive thinking about sustainability and biodiversity. Head west from the Eden Project, passing near the dramatic hilltop island church of St. Michael's Mount, and you'll arrive at Penzance, the most westerly town in England. And then at Land's End, a rocky clifftop site that is the most westerly point in England. Here, you're about 870 miles by road from John O'Groats, which is considered to be the most northeasterly point in Scotland. This distance and the route between the two points is often used for great charity events, runs, bike rides and hikes. The record time for a run between the two points is 9 days, 2 hours and 26 minutes, achieved by a super marathon runner named Andrew Rivett in 2002. Penzance was the home of Sir Humphrey Davy, and a statue of him dominates Market Jew Street, one of the town's central avenues. Davy was a prominent chemist of the late 18th and early 19th century, to whom science and technology owe an enormous debt of gratitude. He built a powerful battery in 1802, when the study of electricity was still in its infancy, and used it to make a strip of platinum glow in the dark. This was almost certainly the world's first electric light, predating Edison by nearly 80 years. Davy is best remembered today for his invention of the miner's safety lamp, whose flame changes colour in the presence of methane without causing an explosion. The statue of Davy in Penzance shows him holding one of these lamps. He became president of the Royal Society and was the first scientist in British history to be given a noble title. Penzance was also the home of the Bronte sisters' mother, Maria Branwell. The Branwell family home, Penlee House, is now an art museum featuring the work of the local Newlyn School, whose members, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, painted naturalistic scenes of the landscape and ordinary people of the area. None of them are big names to hold against the old masters, but many of them, including Walter Langley, Henry Scott Tuke, Elizabeth Forbes and Laura Knight, made attractive paintings of everyday life that are historically informative and nostalgic today. Cornwall is still a magnet for artists. This is partly because it's warmer than most other parts of Britain, partly because the landscape is spectacularly beautiful, and partly because the lack of industry contributes to a crystal clear atmosphere. From Penzance, travel to St. Ives, just a few miles north, and on the Atlantic rather than the Channel coast. It's a cheerful seaside spot, built on a steep hillside with cliffs and sandy beaches below, an old fishing harbour, and dozens of shops selling Cornish fudge and clotted cream, fish and chips, and works of art. Many of the little winding lanes are closed to traffic. Access is often by stone steps. And the place is alive with holidaymakers. It's an unusual mixture of lowbrow and highbrow, with the high end represented by two important art centres. One is a regional branch of London's Tate Gallery. It was opened in 1993 in an impressive, elevated, circular building overlooking the beach and the Atlantic Ocean. White, clean and minimalist in mood, the building itself is a work of art. It then doubled in size with a major refurbishment between 2015 and 2017. Parts of the Tate's immense collection rotates down to St. Ives from London, but this branch also specialises in the work of West Country artists. Nearby, and now also run by the Tate, is the Barbara Hepworth Museum and Sculpture Garden. Hepworth is one of the most prominent modernist sculptors, her name often linked with that of Henry Moore. They both made great solid objects pierced by holes, not representational, but widely admired for the moods and feelings they evoke. Hepworth, originally from Yorkshire, studied sculpture in Italy, tried to popularise European modernism in Britain between the two world wars, and learned how to work on a very large scale with bronze, granite, steel and other industrial materials. In 1949, she moved to St. Ives and stayed there for the rest of her life, acquiring a disused cinema across the street from her house for big projects. She was commercially successful, winning important commissions from British corporations, the government, and even the United Nations in New York, partly because her works fitted well with buildings in the international style. She died in a house fire in 1975 at the age of 72. The next year, the house, patched up and repainted, opened as a museum, and has been linked with the Tate since 1980. A characteristic work visible there is Two Forms Divided Circle. It's a solid bronze circle cut down the middle with a hole in each half that gives the impression of a pair of eyes looking in surprise out of a round face. The modest garden is chock full of her statues, blending with the palm trees, semi-tropical plants and flowers that can survive the mild Cornish winters. Go northeast from St Ives, up the Atlantic shore of Cornwall, and you'll soon be at the ancient fortress of Tintagel. This is another of the great Arthurian sites, and nearly every shop in the nearby village has an Arthurian name and sign. According to the medieval chronicler Geoffrey of Monmouth, this is the place where Arthur was conceived by his mother Igraine, thanks to a bit of devious magic from Merlin. Igraine was married to Duke Gorlois at the time, but King Uther Pendragon was determined to have his way with her. Merlin therefore disguised Uther as Gorlois, smuggled him into Tintagel, and the deed was done without Igraine even realising that she'd been violated. That very night, Gorlois died in battle, leaving the way clear for Uther, back in his usual guise, to woo and marry Igraine and to legitimise Arthur. A sordid tale, but a magnificent place, where Atlantic waves pound against the cliffs. Tintagel is a rocky promontory approached across a footbridge onto what feels like an island. The ruined castle remains are from the 13th century. Even then, the idea that this was the place of Arthur's birth prompted the builder, King Henry III's brother Richard, to use an older style, giving his own contemporaries the feeling that they were entering an ancient place. Tintagel today is one of the most popular visitor destinations in the whole of Britain. English Heritage, who run it, permitted a local sculptor to carve a wizard's face next to the entrance to Merlin's cave in 2016. A proposed new bridge design in a recent competition was supposed to look like the sword Excalibur, and the creation of a larger-than-life statue of Arthur himself is under debate. These proposed changes have led critics to complain that the place is being Disney-fied. It's not an unreasonable complaint. Land's End is now dominated by a theme park, and it would be sad to see the same thing happen here. On the other hand, the sheer scale of Tintagel helps preserve its mood of elemental power. Last time I was there, the wind was so strong, the castle and headland had to be closed for safety reasons. We thwarted visitors had to content ourselves with watching the Atlantic breakers surging into the caves, or with hiking a section of the coastal path which passes through Tintagel and beside its lonely clifftop church. I also went into the medieval post office, the oldest building in the village, whose gravity-defying roofline evokes the world of Tolkien. Thousands of people were at Tintagel, all in waterproofs. This is one of the most popular sites in Britain, and a magnet to folk from all over Europe. Everyone interested in the Arthurian legends wonders whether Tintagel is also the site of Camelot, the home of Arthur's court and the Great Round Table. It's certainly one candidate. A second possibility is Caerleon in South Wales, a Roman stronghold and site of a great round earthwork that's sometimes referred to as the Round Table, but is actually the remains of their amphitheatre. A third Camelot is Cadbury Castle in Somerset, quite near Glastonbury, where this lecture began. It's an Iron Age hill fort, which archaeologists have shown to be the site of large buildings, big settlements, and at least one major battle. A fourth possibility, attractive not least because it actually has a round table, is Winchester Castle in Hampshire. A massive round table hangs on the wall of the Great Hall there, with the names of 24 knights inscribed around the edge. After years of speculation about its age, a group of dendrochronologists, scientists who can date wood by the spacing of the tree rings, tested it in the 1970s, and showed it to come from the late 13th century, probably about 1270. That's far too late for Arthur, who, if he existed at all, lived in the 4th or 5th century. On the other hand, it's a superb object. The fact that a large red rose is painted in the centre shows that it was almost certainly decorated in the era of Henry VIII, the early 1500s. And that the king depicted at the top is meant to be Henry himself,